Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week we are talking reggae history with Al Anderson of the original Wailers. Al spent many years playing and producing music alongside Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, and the rest of the Wailers community, and today Al's going to share a heap of stories and perspective about their lives, their interactions, and of course, their music. We discuss the relationship Bob Marley had with Island Records, Chris Blackwell, meeting the Beatles, and even the last days of Bob Marley's life, and heaps more. Al Anderson and the original Wailers are touring around the world, and they're going to be in Australia June 6th in Brisbane, June 7th in Sydney, June 8th in Melbourne, June 12th in Adelaide, June 13th in Perth, and June 14th in Hillary's. Go to metropolistouring.com for your tickets now. And by the way, if you are in Sydney on June 1st, you can help me celebrate my birthday with Danko Jones. Yep, that's right. Danko Jones is playing the Crowbar in Sydney Saturday night, June 1st, and we are making it a Vinyl Guide birthday celebration. Get a ticket to see Danko Jones that night, Saturday, June 1st, at the Crowbar in Leichhardt, and let's hang out. Bring your friends, we'll have some beers, and enjoy the show. I hope to see you there. And I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout-out to the Vinyl Guide sponsor, GrooveWasher.com. GrooveWasher is the best manual record cleaner on the planet, and every record collector and vinyl enthusiast needs a record cleaner, right? But rather than spend thousands of dollars on a big behemoth spinning platter vacuum cleaner, get a Groove Washer starting around $20, or get their big bundle for $65. Plus, here's an extra 10% off if you enter promo code VINYLGUIDE10. Head over to GrooveWasher.com, stock up on vinyl record cleaning supplies, and get an extra 10% off with promo code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. Help your records sound their very best with the Groove Washer record cleaner. And with that, let's get into today's conversation with Al Anderson of the original Wailers. So, ladies and gentlemen, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we are very proud to have Al Anderson of the original Wailers here on the show. We're going to talk a little bit of vinyl. We're going to talk a little bit of the history of the Wailers and Al's career in general. And, of course, the upcoming shows in Australia in June 2019. Al, how are you today?
It's a wonderful day here in California. I hope you're saying that where you are in Australia.
No, actually, it's getting pretty chilly. So if you're used to California weather, you better bring a jacket. It's getting a little cool here.
You're coming into your winter.
That's right. That's right.
So when you say cold,
it's not like a harsh winter. I mean, it's California cold, right? You know, there's no snow, but. Yeah, no need to bring gloves or anything. Are you California based now? I know you were raised on the East Coast, but you've lived so many places. You've played with bands that are, you know, living out of the UK and Jamaica. Are you California based now, or where is home to you?
Santa Monica here. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful
California.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a great existence, man. And so let's talk a little bit about your upcoming trip. You're coming out to Australia. The original Wailers are playing. And you, my friend, are an original Wailer. How did you first get connected with Bob Marley and become a Wailer?
It had a lot to do with this group called Traffic and Free. We're island groups. Yeah. And when I moved from New York to England, I worked for Virgin Records first. That was my first job. And then I switched from Virgin to Island, you know, from Richard Branson, who was a great, great CEO, to Island Records, Chris Blackwell. And I became very friendly with the track, Stevie Winwood, and, you know, all the guys, Simon Kirk and Andy Frazier. The guys that were in Free, and my good buddy was their lead guitarist, who had the greatest guitar collection from the 50s and 60s that you could ever see in his loft. And I was always over there, like having a couple jars with him and playing his guitars and fixing them up. And Chris Blackwell had called Paul Kossoff, was the lead guitarist. Mm. And he was in great health, couldn't make the session, so he used me. He told Blackwell to send a minicab to pick me up at his apartment, and that I was capable of handling the session that he was offered. So I substituted for him, and Bob asked me to move to Jamaica and be a part of his production team.
Wow. Okay, so if you weren't sitting there amongst Paul Kossoff's guitar collection and drinking those jars, you wouldn't have got handed that gig, no?
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Absolutely.
So you go to the session, and it is, if I'm correct, it's Bob Marley sessions for the Natty Dread album. You are thrust into this situation where really it's a transition period for Bob Marley and the Wailers. Bunny and Peter have just left. Bob is creating the Natty Dread album on his own. What was the environment like?
Very secretive. It was like they didn't want anyone to hear or know anything what he was doing, because they wanted to launch him kind of like, here's Bob Marley and his Wailers on his own without Peter and Bunny. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like really hush. And it was complicated for me because I had to learn the language first. I had to learn patois first so I could really sit in where I was trying to get in. Mm-hmm. And I learned the language, and I played with a lot of artists in Jamaica that normally I would never. I was making a living from doing sessions in Jamaica and not really getting anything from the record company to assist. Mm-hmm. No place to live, no amenities, no per diems, no salary. Mm-hmm. It was just like, you're going to have to wait until we distribute this record. And I slept on the floor of Hope Road Studio for a year before they released Natty Dread, to tell you how rough. I wouldn't change a thing. I tell everybody the same story because it's so true. A lot of us didn't even have anywhere to live. You know, we were just kind of just, we were so involved with rehearsing and recording, because after Natty Dread, it was all about, okay, he had all these songs that he had written that he wants to have produced, and the group was capable of producing the songs that he had written.
So you go to the session, you start playing with Bob Marley. At what point did it go from here's a guy coming in to do a studio gig to joining the Wailers as a touring organization?
Wow, great question. The solo in No Woman, No Cry, he was like, okay, that's enough, because, you know, I had done Roadblock. I had Talking Blues, mm-hmm. and Soul Jase, and he was like, wow. He was like, are you kidding me? And I was like, no, man, you really got it. This sounds great. And he says, look, I got a couple more tracks. Can you handle it? And I said, what do you got? And he said, I got the song No Woman, No Cry. So he asked me, what do you hear? And I said, well, I hear a lot of things. I hear you don't have them on the records yet. Horn section, slide guitar, acoustic guitar, and so on. Mm-hmm. For the session itself, but for No Woman, No Cry, he just wanted me to play a lead on top of it. And he gave me the song, and I played it twice. I played it once, straight through. And all I remember is that I just saw a bunch of people jumping up and down and enjoying the end of the song, so I knew it was over. And then Chris said, Chris Blackwell said, that's good. Let's try it one more time. So I think I played it too perfect the second time, because I liked the second track of No Woman, No Cry, because I knew the song. And they liked the kind of like, you know, stuttering around and not really...
Your exploratory, you know, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't like I was thinking instead of just executing, and they wanted the thought process in the song because it felt more natural how the track was recorded in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So after that, it was like he just came and said, look, man, who are you working with? I said, well, at the moment, I'm working with, you know, Oswald in Delaware, Washington. And he was like, man, I'd love for you to come and be a part of my production team mm-hmm. in Jamaica and whatever it takes to get you there. And I was like, just a ticket and a contract is good enough. So we organized one piece of it anyway. And I'm in Jamaica, and now I'm living in Hope Road. I live at Hope Road Studio for years.
Mm.
And I thought that I would have, a lot better amenities and, salary and per diem. But apparently Bob at that time wasn't as financially secure as he was after they released the album. Took a long time to get it together, to get the record packaged, where there was nothing in the way of launching him and any confusion about him, who he was touring with, and who was going to be part of the production team to get him that music every single night. Mm-hmm. And that was very complicated. It took a while.
It sounds like that time is really his career transition. He went from being part of a band to really being known as a solo artist outside of that, with the Wailers, with his production team.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Peter and Bunny really didn't want to leave the band. I think it was more of like the record company was suggesting that he did things by himself. And if they were going to ever get back together, that was a possibility because they all lived in the same place. But Bob really wanted to prove himself as a singer-songwriter with his new production of musicians, opposed to how things were going in the early 70s.
So with my limited understanding of kind of what was happening and the personalities at that time, my interpretation is that Peter and Bunny left the Wailers because of business differences, not creative differences. Is that accurate? Were they still getting along with Bob? Were they still friends?
They loved each other, basically, always did. There was some, problems with how record company executives, when they want something, they want it as fast as they want it. And Bob was suspect to be like the person who left the Wailers, but I think that it had a lot to do with the record company itself influencing Bob that he needed to let these guys do exactly what he wanted to do, which was Peter Tosh wanted to play with other musicians without Bob or Bunny. Mm-hmm. Bunny Wailer wanted to produce, write his own songs. They all did, and they all became hugely successful. He had three amazing songwriters that didn't need each other to write songs. I thought they needed each other to perform, but they didn't need each other to write songs because I had been on stage with all three of them, and there's nothing like it.
Hmm.
I mean, until you've done that, the Wailers were really cool. Bob Marley and the Wailers were dynamite because you had Tyrone Downey, Wire, the I-Trees, and just what Bob does. Without me, let's say. And then I'm just looking at it all without me. Without me, Peter Tosh is amazing. With me and his band, I'm a very happy camper. And the same with recording with Bunny. They were amazing. Mm-hmm. And they became, they became more mature where they didn't need each other and that they wanted to show their independence, and they did.
It's almost like the Beatles, You've got Lennon and McCartney and George Harrison.
Exactly. And now that you mention that, John Lennon, I went to dinner with Yoko and John because John wanted to do a Revolution album with Bob. He wanted to get together with Bob, write some songs, and go in the studio and do an album with somebody who was very much like himself. And then later on, when John went through his journey and the band broke up and so on and it was completely over for the Beatles. John Lennon had made it clear that he was his empathy towards going to the studio with the Wailers and doing an album
what
with
year,
his guys.
What
and,
year was this?
Wow, this is like 70, 5.
Okay.
Right after Nazi Dread was released, and we had a lot of hit songs in England. You know, most of the album were number one songs, and we were getting a lot of exposure. And later on, as the late 70s came around, George Harrison and Paul McCartney came to the Madison Square Garden, where we opened for the Commodores, and expressed that they had interest to go in the studio with them as well.
So there were so many people that were looking to hitch their wagon to the Wailers. What was always the gating factor? Because, look, John Lennon or the Stones or any of these bands could really make an album happen if they wanted to. Why do you think that these proposed projects tended to fall apart?
Bob was really shy, man. He didn't know how to really deal with, like, superstars. He was cool, but Beatles, Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, they came to Hope Road for his publishing and wanted to give him anything for a piece of his publishing. He got really shy, and not like scared or like, you know, premature or anything. He didn't know how to deal with these guys, because they were getting, you know, $10 million advances from, you know, Walter Yetnikoff and Sony. And he didn't think that he had the possibility of getting that type of consideration. But Michael and Quincy showed him that whatever he wanted, that if he was willing to leave Island Records and get some of his publishing to Sony or CBS, that Quincy and Michael were capable of giving him equally. And if Bob had left Island Records in 77, 78, like he was thinking of doing, he thought of it because it's Michael Jackson and Quincy fucking Jones. You know, two really big icons in this business that would help anybody's career. He decided to be very faithful to Island and stay with Island because that's the kind of guy he was.
So the working relationship with Chris Blackwell, I hear a lot of stories that there's a lot of adversarial relationships, but it sounds like Bob and Chris had a great relationship, or at least Bob was under Chris's spell somehow. What was your view of it?
He was on guard. It was on guard at all times because, first of all, Bob was a political activist and had a lot of people angry that he wanted Michael Manley to be prime minister again, and towards the 80s, before his journey. And for me, Chris was really intelligent as a record company exec. He wasn't so humanitarian when it came to conditions. He thought that the worse it was for us, the better we would produce. And he was 100% correct, because Chris is Jamaican. His English, as he speaks and how literate he is from his learnings, for me, I was like, wow, I didn't know how to take him. I had a lot of respect for him and honor for what he did for me, but how he took care of his singer-songwriters like Dennis Brown, Jimmy Cliff, he wasn't giving royalties, and he took merchandise, and he was really so smart in the business at that time. He utilized the fact that Jamaica's Performing Rights Society had no merit to the singers and songwriters of Jamaica, and only the record distributors and CEOs were the ones who would make the lion's share of the royalties, which they didn't deserve. I believe that if you're a songwriter, you get 100% of your publishing. If you're a record distributor, you cut a deal, and whatever that deal is, you live with. Chris was a part of our production after a while because he realized that. He would put produced by Chris Blackwell, Bob Marley, and the Wailers. And Bob Marley's music was produced by the Wailers, Bob Marley. Bob Marley did all the songwriting, the Wailers did all the production, and Chris would come to Jamaica and say, oh, put a cherry here and put a strawberry there, and then all of a sudden he was part of the production.
Right.
As a CEO, I for me, it was very disturbing because I'm an American citizen, and Jamaican singers and songwriters deserve what any American deserves. They deserve their royalties. They deserved a proper merchandise contract and a proper distribution deal. These are three dynamic things that keeps anybody alive and well today. The Wailers are not rich. They're poor as a band. And that the sad thing is that there were so many spies and there were so many dishonest people that wanted to know what was on Bob's mind, what the Wailers were thinking, that it became annoying because you knew that, well, all these island executives don't really care about us at all. They're more interested in the longevity of these songs becoming number one hits, record sales, and how the merchandise would be to suit island. And it was strange working for a company like that because CBS wasn't like that, and Sony for me wasn't like that, and Virgin really wasn't like that. And it just seemed as though this one guy who was a really clever guy who was very likable and very cultural minded and had, you know, he didn't walk as he talked. It was like, wow, he's promising all these things. But financially, the Wailers band members got, like, you know, knocked out of the box by all the spies, the lawyers the island had. It was horrible. It was, that's when it got really bad. It got bad for Bob, too, because he knew he deserved a better royalty rate. He wanted to go to Sony and CBS and get more money, but he wanted to stay true to his beginnings, his humble beginnings, so he did. Wow. That's the kind of guy he was.
Okay. Yeah, because I imagine he would have seen all these different things happening around him. John Lennon and all these Quincy Jones taking him out to dinners and trying to do projects. The power he had on even getting politicians elected. I mean, did he acknowledge this ability that he had?
Bob was not a pop star. He was like Che Guevara. Bob was amazing. He had met Castro. He got only two terms. I think he got back-to-back terms from the backing of the band and Bob's influence.
Yep.
Bob was a hero. He really was like a saint because he had heavenly thoughts because of his philosophy. And unfortunately, he got really tough because when people started to try to poison him and assassinate him, he realized that this music business and politics is no joke, and that he wasn't going to change anything, but he had to be very careful of how he was producing so much energy in the world that he became a target for the FBI, the CIA. And
do you believe Bob Marley was assassinated?
He was poisoned. Absolutely. Bob Marley was poisoned. I don't know how the poison got in his body, but it was really easy to get to him and influence him to be a friend and share whatever that would knock him out. Because I met him in 1973 in December. He was one of the fittest young guys ever. Bob was really fit. He trained hard. He played really good football. He did a lot of physical sports. Exercises with his friend Skill Cole, his manager at one time, who was a great footballer. He played ball like 3-4 times a day. That's all. He was just so healthy. And then all of a sudden, he wasn't healthy anymore, and it was a drastic turnaround for us to all see that something is terribly wrong, and it doesn't seem like it's going to last a long time.
How quick did he go from being sick to passing on?
About a year and a half. You know, when we got to Munich, we were with Josef Issel, who's Hitler's doctor. What is Bob Marley doing in Munich with Hitler's doctor? With all the doctors out there, I have no idea. And it's just he was in the Bavarian hills, and it was like -5 degrees, and he was having chemotherapy and radiotherapy
and all these experiments to keep him alive. And his health just kept declining. He had great moments where he got better. Mm-hmm. And then a week or two later, you couldn't understand how this guy could be one of the fittest guys on the block to where he's literally going to his journey of passing. Mm-hmm. Really. I regret everything that happened. It was terrible, man.
Were you able to
regret it? And I cried.
Were you able to speak with him and be?
No, I was right there with him in the trenches. When he went to Bavaria, I came like about a couple weeks later and stayed with him the last 4 days of his life. Mm. I stayed up there for like 5 months during his therapy with the German doctor. He seemed to be very, professional, but he was giving him holistic therapies and, chemo and radio. Mm-hmm. So they went all out, and you could see that it was taking its toll on him. I just think that he was isolated in a very strange place. He didn't understand what people, television was complicated. He's just sitting there trying to, he just said that all I want to do is get back to Jamaica and go on tour and sing with you guys, get the band rehearsing. That's all I want. He physically couldn't. And it was just a nightmare. And it is still a nightmare now that he's not here with us, because he was an amazing character.
Now, is he still getting high right up until the very end?
No.
No?
No. What people don't realize is that they say he smoked like a pound a week. Not true. He smoked when it was convenient for him. Sometimes he didn't smoke at all.
No?
Now, Peter Tosh was a smoker. That guy could smoke. He's a long guy. Got a long lift. He was constant. And Bob had so many things happening that there was no time.
Right.
He had to really pay attention to all the mathematics that were being calculated around.
Sure. And you played with Peter Tosh on a couple of his, tremendously popular albums, including Legalize It, which incredibly radical. How risky was it releasing an album like Legalize It at the time?
The New York State Commission didn't love Sony CBS for that. The FBI didn't like it whatsoever. So they had a file, along with Bob Marley, had a FBI and a CIA file on him. They thought he was a revolutionist and so on and so forth and all the bullshit. And Peter was, just an amazing songwriter and character, but he didn't like politics the way Bob did, and he talked down at the president, apostrophe S, in the world, and caused him a lot of mayhem for himself.
They seem to be, Bob and Peter Tosh seem to be almost like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Like, one takes a very radical approach, and the other is looking at a more peaceful, collaborative result.
That is exactly perfect statement.
When you were staying in Jamaica, you stayed on Hope Road, and inside Hope Road, there were a few studios that were creating their records. Were you involved, or did you get much exposure to the pressing plants or the process of the actual record creation that they had in Jamaica?
Man, I saw it all. Bob had a pressing plant in the back of Hope Road in our studio, in our rehearsal hall.
Wow.
Which was illegal, but he did it anyway. He did it anyway because he wanted to get a royalty. Chris Blackwell had all of Europe and America, and he had all the Caribbean. He was selling, later on, after the mid-70s, he was selling millions of albums on his own, becoming a very lucrative record tough gun executive himself.
Oh, okay. So Bob essentially able to enrich himself largely off selling records within Jamaica. That was the area that he owned distribution rights to, yeah?
Within all of the Caribbean. Mm. St. Kitts, St. Croix.
Right.
Did very well. People would come, all the small islands, and just literally buy thousands of vinyl CDs of whatever we were producing or whatever we had available, what was left. So he started selling so many records in the Caribbean that he illegally and literally built a pressing plant in our rehearsal room and started pressing his own records on Top Gun and becoming very seriously financially together. He bought the studio. He bought everything in the studio. He bought the pressing plant. When the Prime Minister Siaga would cut the power on our side, he literally cut the power on our side because we were too progressive and he knew what was going on. But he also wanted Bob to get him elected. So he became very friendly with Bob, knowing everything that was going on and what, you know, how his philosophy and his thoughts. But he also knew that Michael Manley would be the biggest competition for him, who Bob favored and had a lot of love for. He liked Michael much more than Siaga.
Mm-hmm. So eventually the power wasn't cut so much to the Tuff Gong studio, no?
As Michael Manley became president, yes. everything was better when Siaga was in power. It was kind of risque for Marley because, you know, Michael was a little bit on the communist. The opposing prime minister, Eddie Siaga, was George Bush Sr.'s Harvard roommate. Bush Sr., when he became the head of the CIA, he went to his old friend in Jamaica and said that, I want you to be the head of the CIA for all the Caribbean and keep an eye on the Caribbean and let us know if there's any communism, because, you know, you got Cuba, who's very communist, and Bob was a Cuban communist sympathizer. It was a danger to the Western Hemisphere, and that is a lot of why the problem started.
Well, I want to end this interview on a positive note. Let's talk about the original Wailers coming to Australia. I've got a feeling that you and I could talk for hours on end. It's absolutely fascinating, and I'd love to have you back on the show at some point, Al. The band is coming out to Australia.
Sure.
What can the audience expect from an original Wailers show?
They're going to take over. There's going to be a sing-along. We're going to play, and the audience is going to sing along with us. And that's what happens every night. Our fans love our catalog, and they know all the words. And we just stop singing, and we literally give them the mic. We got people coming up on stage singing, and the whole audience is singing along. It's a sing-along, and you're going to hear some original material that we've written and produced also.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I would imagine you would have, you know, thousands of people singing these songs that are really, I mean, internal to them. I mean, these songs are ones that are really, at this point, part of the human DNA. So each night sounds like a big festival that people aren't just watching, but they're participating as well.
We bring them in. Once they start, we just say, okay, here it goes. You got it. We play and they sing. It's really neat. Great feeling knowing that all this time they haven't forgotten the songs that we've played and we're responsible for.
That'll never happen. You know that as well as anyone, Al.
We love our Australian fans, man. We love them.
So let me just make sure everyone knows the original Wailers are coming to Australia. You go to Metropolis Touring to see the dates. June 6th in Brisbane, June 7th in Sydney. I'll certainly be at that one. June 8th in Melbourne. June 12th in Adelaide, then the 13th in Perth, and then on June 14th, Hillary's, which I'm not sure where that's at, but I'll have to do a little bit of homework to find out where Hillary's is at. I imagine that's on the West Coast.
Make sure that you come up and let us know who you are so we can give you material and some merchandise and so on.
Oh, okay. All right. I definitely will. Do you guys still get high?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
If you have some spinach, definitely bring it along.
I'm sure the Metro Theater in Sydney is going to have that stench lingering for some weeks after that show. Uh-huh. I'll definitely make myself known in Sydney on June 7th. And Al, thanks again for coming on the show.
Say hello. We're going to talk to you again.
We'll do, man.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Al Anderson of the Original Wailers. And to anyone who's listening, I must be clear, I am not the type to partake in getting high. I'd love to have that kind of time, but sadly, I'm much too much of a type A personality to spend my spare time smoking doobies. So to any listeners, family, or my kids' teachers who may be listening, I have no judgment against those who do partake. I'm just too much of a control freak to do that myself. So I hope that clears that up. Also, doing some research after the interview, I cannot find a direct connection between Bob Marley's doctor and Adolf Hitler. And I got to tell you, that is such a strange sentence to say out loud, but I had to dig a little bit deeper. Apparently, the doctor that treated Bob Marley was known as a bit of a quack and a member of the Nazi party at one point in his life, but I did some Googling, I did some searching, and I cannot find a direct link between him and Hitler. Also, some of the dates that Al shared, everything seemed a bit misaligned here and there. I'm sure there's a logical reason behind it. You know, Al's lived this very long life, with very colorful, with a lot of different people, so things may get jumbled here and there. Let's just go back to my original topic of smoking doobies, and that may explain a fair portion of it. What I'm extremely clear on is that the Original Wailers are playing in Australia at the beginning of June, and it's definitely going to be a show you want to check out. Go to metropolistouring.com for dates and tickets. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast either through Apple iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. But don't forget, there are Vinyl Guide podcast apps available at the Apple Store and at the Google Play Store. Just go there, search for The Vinyl Guide. You'll be able to download the app and access all 160 billion episodes and interviews that we have done since the beginning of time. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.